Good morning and welcome. A lot of people with bleary-eyed look this morning. And between this and the traffic, we decided to just delay this a few minutes. I'm extremely pleased this morning, and the timing on this couldn't be better. CSIS has hosted the last few kind of rollouts of the International Energy Outlook for 2003, 4, 5, and now 6. But I'm extremely pleased today because we have presenting for us this morning Ambassador Bill Ramsey, who's familiar to all of you. He's the Deputy Executive Director at the IEA. He's also the one responsible for relations with non-OECD, non-IEA countries, which are going to become increasingly important as we go forward. Known Bill for a long time, former colleague, good friend. He was at the State Department, and that's where a lot of you know him from before he went to the IEA, where he was in charge of international energy policy, foreign and economic sanctions, and strategic commodities, which covers a lot of territory. So the presentation will be posted on our website later today. We'll have questions at the end. This is all kind of on the record, and I'd like to introduce you to Ambassador Bill Ramsey. Yeah, Bill.
Thank you. Is everybody able to hear my voice back there around the corner? Fine. Okay. Well, this is a hardcore energy group, and you've seen these presentations before. And since you've given me as much as 2 hours, you're going to get the full Monty. I apologize for that before I even start. We're putting forward a world energy outlook this time that's a little bit more of a warning, a little bit more urgent. Not using the words catastrophe and crisis, but we're crowding those kinds of words as we explore what's been going on. You'll see that there's a lot of similarity between the base case and the enhanced policy scenario, the alternative policy scenario, because things don't, on a 30-year time horizon, they don't change overnight. You're going to see a new world for coal. We're going to criticize investment, not necessarily levels, but whether it's the right kind of investment. And we're going to talk about prices having an impact generally on situations that lead to the wrong signals getting into marketplace, to mishaps, and to perhaps even crises. We expect that governments could take a much more aggressive role in addressing some of the challenges we're putting forward here. And who knows, but with a new dawn in Washington, you may have an ability to look at some of these things in slightly different ways here in Washington. I have to tell you, the world waits for Washington. It waits for Washington's leadership. You may think that these things are going on without you. They are not. They're waiting for you. So the sooner Washington picks up some of these challenges and the U.S. industry, the faster we're going to get on with it. I'll talk a little bit about the Energy Technology Perspectives also, which is a book that you all saw last June, July. Here are the schedule that you've probably become familiar with. The reference scenario with energy growing 53% between now and 2030. The projected rate of growth is a little bit slower, 1.6% per year. It was 1.8% over the 1980 to 2004 schedule. But here demand reaches 17.1 billion tons of oil equivalent, up from 11.2 in 2004. All fuels increase in relative terms, oil staying the biggest as before. Demand for gas growing at 2%, but coal is going to remain the largest fossil fuel after oil all the way out to 2030. You'll remember that last year, year before, we had gas and oil crossing at 2010. That has changed. We retain the position that this is an unsustainable future. It's unsustainable for a lot of reasons: economic exposure to fuels imported from elsewhere, security exposure, balance of payments exposures, runaway CO2, continuing poverty around the rest of the world. The bottom line there, I'll try to catch bottom lines if they're cut off by the table. That just says that coal is increasing rather more rapidly in absolute terms than it did before. You have to bear in mind that this schedule is from 2006 back. Who has been creating that line? Who has been drawing that line? Well, you can see that OECD is 49% of total world consumption. But if you add the 5% around the world in the Chinas, in the Russias, there's at least 5% of the population in African countries that are consuming sort of on a par with Western European or American consumption. They have cars, refrigerators, air conditioning, all the rest. It's only about 2 billion people in the world that are really consuming the energy that you see in the first part of our schedule. And what we're saying in the second part of the schedule from 2006 to 2030 is that we've got to start drawing in a lot more of the other 4 billion people. And if you do that in a way that we are consuming energy now, if a big chunk of those 4 billion consume energy the way we do, we're all going to get at least our feet wet, and we're not going to be able to breathe. This will be a fairly uninhabitable place. So for the next 30, 40 years, we've got to find a different way of achieving the same product from energy services that we get now, but in a way that uses a lot less energy and somehow decarbonizes that energy mix. Do we have the resources to bring those other 4 billion people into the game? Well, not all at once, but this is a schedule that we have in a reserves to resources book we put out some while ago that says if you increase the hurdle rate for investors from, say, $25 to $45, look at the difference you get in the resource base that's available to you. That's a lot less concentration in the Middle East than you would expect if we didn't have higher prices. Some wells that have been plugged up are being reopened. Enhanced oil recovery techniques are making a lot more available. There's quite a bit going on that would suggest the resource base is really larger. Instead of worrying about Shell cutting back on its reserve figures, we ought to be putting out figures that show that resource base has expanded dramatically. The bottom OPEC Middle East obviously is very conservative because it's going to expand also dramatically as prices go out to $45 a barrel. A lot of that part of the world hasn't even been explored yet. So who's going to make the investments? Well, if you look at the big three, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, again, we're in the reference scenario here. This is where you would suppose you would get a good bit of that incremental oil. OPEC Middle East would see the fastest growth, growing from 34 million barrels a day in 2005 to 56 in 2030 in the reference scenario. Market share would rise from 40 to 48% in 2030. Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq holding some 26% of that OPEC share. Non-OPEC would grow more slowly in the reference scenario. But you would see in our price scenarios, which use higher reference prices, you'll see that in the publication, there is an encroachment by non-conventional, Athabasca, the Orinoco, possibly other shales eventually, into the energy mix. And non-OPEC conventional, fairly small. That, again, the reference scenario. Got a lot of pictures here, and I got to get them in the right order. So what's actually happening? Now, the reference scenario goes out to 2030, but here we've taken a snapshot of 2006 to 2010. So here's what's happening in the rest of the world. The distribution of investment, as you can see on the right-hand side, is only 23% OPEC. So even though they got 65% of the world's reserves, only 23% of the dollars are flowing into that neck of the woods. So that this concept of a deferred investment scenario we put out last year, where OPEC, for whatever reasons, doesn't produce as much as it could, and we've seen this again in Doha recently at the informal session, Abu Dhabi, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait talking about reductions, trying to hold a market price of who knows what. Is it $60? What's 60? Is it 60 OPEC basket, 55? Nobody talks about that with any precision, but it's very high. And we in the agency have taken the position it's altogether too high. But this is the distortion that's taking place, leading to much less investment flow into OPEC than you would expect given the resource allocation, the endowments. If you have prices operating at $50, $60 a barrel, there's no reason to suppose that couldn't continue for quite some time and that you might not find as large a share for OPEC in the future as would be suggested by the resource base. Looking a little bit at gas, there we see a mismatch again between the resource endowment and demand, a great deal more trade, OECD Europe growing by some 280 BCM by 2030. That would put them at some 65% imports. North America, largely self-sufficient, but perhaps as much as 16% of its needs by 2030. LNG obviously would be serving that need. Where would this be coming from? Where is this gas going to happen? Well, it's supposed to happen in Iran and Russia because they hold the gas. But here's another example. We have, from the IEA, been fussing about Russian gas for some time. They're not making the investments. Three fields that have supported Russian capacity are in decline. Only Zapoljarnoye has been going to compensate for the three declining fields. There is nothing happening greenfield. There's no incremental investment going on. They've been relying on Turkmen gas, Uzbek, Kazakh gas. That hasn't worked. We've got a deliverability issue in Russia right now. Iran, on the other hand, some of the companies around the table have got investments going on in there. The South Pars project has got a tremendous amount of gas. down the South Pars, you get some exportable gas. But every time the President Ahmadinejad says something about wiping Israel off the face of the map, anybody who's investing out there says, oops, I got a board of directors. This may not be the time for the next $1 billion. And so the whole thing is slowing down. The Iranian arrival in the marketplace is slowing down. It's just not going to be there when we'd like to see it happen. So now we have curious things where LNG is tying markets together. We saw it in the Gulf of Mexico. We've seen it at other times of stress in the U.S. Northeast. The Henry Hub is kind of putting a floor price right now under world LNG. It's a curious time. This is the time for watching carefully how these markets integrate. They are no longer as separated as they used to be. But at today's prices in Europe, indexed to oil commodities, for whatever reason I couldn't tell you, at $280 a thousand cubic meters, there's plenty of incentive, and a lot of stranded gas is feeling less lonely than it did some short while ago. Here's coal demand. We have seen a considerable increase in coal demand. This again is the reference scenario. Biggest increase in absolute terms. That China and India would be accounting for some 4/5 of the incremental demand for coal. This is to 2030. It's driven by high prices. We have internalized in here now a higher set of reference prices, so you can see a greater focus on coal. Traditional coal consumers are returning to coal. You'll see that in Germany, the United Kingdom, the United States. In the United States, the marginal supply of electricity right now is not gas, it's coal. It's just driven by the economics. The last 3 years have seen an increase in coal consumption of 1.1 billion tons, which is roughly what we saw increase in world consumption of coal in the last 3 years, 1.1 billion tons, which is comparable to the increase between 1979 and 2003, 14 years. China has increased its coal consumption in the last 2 years. I think I have a slide here to show a bit of that. I'll come to a slide on China because there's a fairly dramatic development there. Basically, the story is that when we estimated Chinese production, I'm going back here in time. I'm away from the reference scenario here. Now I'm taking the snapshot at a point in time back in 2000. When we estimated Chinese coal consumption for 2005 back in 2002, our estimate and our projection was roughly the same as the others, the NDRC and various other projections. We missed by 400 million tons. That's the kind of a price response that we have seen in the Chinese market to high oil and gas prices. If you want to build power plants and if you've got increasing demand, it's going to be in coal. So there, in terms of the last 4 years, is what happened in coal. Now, that's been internalized in the current reference scenario. Obviously, the consequences of that, fairly straightforward. Now, we're back to the reference scenario again. Growth in energy at 1.6%. This is a little bit slower. The carbon dioxide growth is 1.7%. The growth in energy is 1.6%. And the reason carbon dioxide is growing faster than energy is because of the projection in the reference scenario of a heavier focus on coal and a declining focus on nuclear. So you've got a more carbonized energy mix going forward. Power sector is creating about half of this to 2030. And China accounts for about 40% of the increase between 2004 and 2030. And China in 2010 becomes a greater producer, emitter of carbon dioxide than the United States. Remembering that all the way out to 2030, China per capita is still only 60% of the OECD. Looking at the... I just added a line there. Right. Looking at the energy-related emissions by region, developing countries account for over 3/4 of the increase in global CO2 emissions between 2004 and 2030. They overtake the OECD as the biggest emitter around 2012. The share of developing countries in world emissions rises from 39% now to 52% in 2030. This increase is faster than that of their share in energy demand because their incremental energy is much more carbon intensive, in particular, again, coal in India and China. We can't solve the global challenges. There's the crossover point to 2010. without the rest of the world. We have been struggling to engage the rest of the world in the Kyoto discussions, but they are not really interested in Kyoto. They are interested in growth. They are interested in efficiency. They are interested in clean fuels, but they don't want to talk about Kyoto. And there is the rest of non-OECD, in which you find China is a part of that one as well. Another finding in our WEO study this year is in investment. The cumulative investment that is required to meet the energy supply out to 2030, the infrastructure requirements, it's over 20 trillion now. And you'll remember that's 3 trillion higher than it used to be just last year. This is especially in the oil and gas industry. All of us have seen the increased costs of bringing oil and gas on stream, the services, even the base metals that go into the equipment. All of these costs have gone up. Investment in the power sector, more than 11 trillion, 56 of which is that doesn't make any sense at all in my notes. I'll just move to the next point. we'll fix that one before the next presentation. Okay, moving on. Oil investment, 4.3 trillion, or just one-fifth of the total. That's about three-quarters of that investment is in the upstream. Gas investment, 3.9 trillion, 56% upstream. And coal investment, just 560 billion. There's another indication of how cheap it is to bring that on. 3% of total energy investment. That's much less capital intensive than either gas or oil. More than half of the energy investment is required in the developing countries. China alone needs about 3.7 trillion. Russia and other transition economies, 9%. And OECD for the remaining 37%. Now, the reason the OECD is so high, it's about 8 trillion of that, is that it has this huge infrastructure that needs to be replaced. And so a good proportion of the money spent in the OECD is just to keep the existing infrastructure up and running. It isn't to meet incremental demand. In fact, over time, you find OECD demand in general falling off. A look at the upstream oil and gas investment and the impact of the cost inflation that we've been talking about there. Cement, steel, materials, all of that, oil field equipment, services, energy, input costs, all of that is raising the cost tremendously, so that the nominal value of the investment over the last years has been increasing dramatically. But if you take a cost-inflated look at that, it's a little less impressive. This is to suggest that we're not really getting that many more barrels out of the ground, that's to say wells dug, wells drilled, than we were before, but we're paying a great deal more to do it. This is about 40 major companies that we've canvassed here, 80% of global production. So there's a fairly good sample here. Remember, this is predicated on the 4 trillion in the reference scenario. And so if you go back to my slide that said the investment is not going into those places that you would expect it to go, it's not going into the Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Iran, Iraq, it's going other places. The investment requirement that we have of 4 trillion is probably quite low. It's quite low because in the Caspian or in deep offshore West Africa, Brazil, you've got to spend a lot more money to get that oil out of the ground. So that 4 that we've talked about is low if the oil doesn't come from Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, the lower cost production areas. Hello, Jonathan. Here again, the deferred investment scenario that we've talked about. Get the order right here. The reference scenario, right axis in the red, the deferred investment scenario, and the deferred investment scenario sort of reflects what I was showing you in that slide. Actually, what I was showing in the slide with only 23% going into OPEC is rather more aggressive than the deferred investment scenario, because the deferred investment sort of predicates the lower investments in the Middle East, North African countries on either a policy decision not to put as much oil on the market for price reasons, or the getting of the investment climate simply wrong, that the terms and conditions of investing in a Kazakhstan or a Russia right now or Iran, Iraq, elsewhere are such that the investment dollars don't flow, and so you get a lower investment profile, the green line on the bottom. If those investments go to other places around the world, it just gets more expensive. A lack of investment? Well, I could have had a different picture. This is Italy one fine August morning, Sunday morning in August, not long ago, where the lights went out. This was a problem in switching back and forth between Switzerland and Italy. We don't know yet what happened in Germany, but there is some likelihood that windmills were involved. That will be interesting. Somebody will have to explain that to the people who think windmills are the answer to the future. Fine. This is a lack of investment. This is a lack of organization in terms of getting the regulatory circumstances right, getting the messages right, getting the policies decided in the first place. Who's going to invest in peak capacity or above peak capacity? Who's going to put in the power line that's going to reinforce the system as opposed to deliver kilowatt hours? Nobody's going to do that if the regulators don't get it right. So we have a major problem. We've all burnt off now our surplus capacity. After 20, 25 years of efficiency and competition and the rest of it, we've burnt off the capacity that the public utilities put on in the earlier decades. And it's time to find now a system that actually responds to security of supply and to consumers' needs as opposed to the purely economic efficiency commercial arguments that we've been putting – competition arguments that we've been putting forward for some time. Another consequence of the way we're consuming energy now, indoor pollution. This is one that we've been using around the world a good bit to make the point that the line we've been taking publicly out of the IMF, out of the OECD, out of the World Bank is, gosh, it's surprising how well we're getting by with these energy prices. We're not responding. The economies are doing fine. They continue to grow. The argument we've been making is that we're not measuring all of it. There's a lot of stuff that we're just not seeing out there. If you consider that smoke from biomass, smoke inhalation, is causing more deaths than malaria around the rest of the world, and if you consider that the frontier between biomass and commercial fuels is shifting back into the cities, it's in the cities that this is the worst because you're combusting the biofuels inside of closed quarters. You can see this happening. We've got a picture here from Africa, Central African Republic, that shows the sort of charcoal web around towns. The little red names there are towns, and those are the trails that lead out from the towns, and you can see where people are going out and harvesting wood, converting it into charcoal, taking it back into town, or just the wood itself. And these are small towns. The same thing is happening in big towns. The same thing is happening in cities. So there's a great deal more biomass being consumed than there was recently. Already we had been projecting 1.5 billion people wouldn't have access to modern energy services by 2030. This is only getting worse, and that's not being measured. You don't measure welfare when you're talking about the demand elasticity or the price elasticity in OECD countries. Another picture of the same sort. Here is a study done in Tanzania for how far people have to walk to get firewood, coming back with 10 kilograms on their head. The average African woman, Lake Tanganyika, the woman walks 5 kilometers in an area called Singida. She walks 10 kilometers a day. And you can imagine the guys are not doing this. This is ladies' work. How much productivity is lost? How much other activity could there be if those folks weren't walking that far to get wood? The average African woman across the entire continent, 8 kilometers a day. I don't do that in a week. So, absent some new energy policies, we've got some problems. Security of supply of oil supply is threatened. Oil production in non-OPEC set to peak. You could argue that from the international oil company's perspective, access to conventional oil has already peaked. You can't get at it. Everybody else has it, but you can't get at it. You're not welcome there. So oil production in non-OPEC set to peak. Production increasingly concentrated in a small number of countries. Again, we're in the reference scenario here. If indeed the major oil resource holders produce the oil that they have, that's what would happen over time. It may not if they continue in their deferred investment scenario. But gas security is not a heck of a lot better. We have seen over these last days Europe's production has peaked. Russia's production for the moment has peaked. It doesn't have to have, but it has for the moment. U.S. to follow, well, I'm not sure it hasn't already. U.S. came across a deliverability problem some while ago, and so this is a very new and major factor in international gas markets. And import dependence everywhere around the world will grow absent new policies. Now, this is a trap because import dependence leads politicians to talk about independence, and it's really a silly argument, and I hope we don't have to start over again with the next administration saying it's not about dependence, it's about vulnerability, it's about economic exposure, it's about transport, it's not about barrels of oil that you import. Exporters pay the same price that you do, except in Iran, of course, and some other places. And if we don't get busy on this, we're going to lose a lot of ground. If you don't make these investments in the next 10 years, given the burst of growth that we're having around the world outside of the OECD, those power plants are going in now, and they're going in fast. If we don't get the right decisions made on those power plants, we're going to be living with them for the next 50 or 60 years. So then we turn to the alternative policy scenario, some of which you have seen in the past. Again, mapping a better future. What are the policies that are under consideration in governments? What could governments do? We have identified about 1,400 policies. This is more than last year, but we've refined the policies. We've got deeper into the sectors and trying to analyze exactly what kind of an impact you might get out of some of those things. We can do a great deal to stimulate energy to reduce energy demand, growth in energy demand, demand-side management issues in appliances, in buildings, around the circuit that we haven't done before, stimulating alternative energy production. Here is basically the transport challenge. We're going to have to find a way to deal better with transport, and there are a lot of solutions out there, not the least of which is efficiency. We could get around for a lot less. Some people are waking up to diesel, and diesel is being cleaned up in such a way that it isn't the greasy old stuff that used to pollute European cities. It's a lot better. Cars are zippy. There's a good reason to do this. Oil savings, just by the policies that we're considering up in the first point, could be 5 million barrels a day, and CO2 emissions could be substantially lower by 2030, some 16%. That's a lot. 6 gigatons. If you could do that again, you're on your way to stabilization. But again, the same comment, we've got to get started on this. If we don't in these first 10 years, then we lose a lot of ground. If you have to make a general statement about this, it has an uncomfortable look of last year's and the year before's assessments of alternative policy scenarios. Some of the policies we talked about a couple of years ago have been enacted, but the population of policies being talked about has not changed that much. So there's a lot more smoke here than there is fire. I think we need to move more rapidly and with a lot more commitment to getting some of these policies actually on the books and operating. Thank you. The alternative policy scenario has the OECD peaking at 31 million barrels a day in 2015, and then actually the OECD begins to fall. You get a substantial savings out there at 2030. Developing countries continue to increase, so that the major turning point is for OECD economies. China and India begin to temper their imports, but they still rise significantly. They will go from 9 million barrels a day to 11.5. Still a lot of growth in that part of the world. Global energy supply in the alternative energy scenario, because there is lower demand because of efficiency, renewables, and some other things happening, there is a little less price pressure, and so we have the same price assumptions in the alternative policy scenario as we have in the reference scenario. It's a combination of renewables, higher nuclear, a great deal of efficiency. It takes the pressure off of supply, and the ones who feel that the most are the higher cost suppliers in Russia, Caspian, deep offshore. So that you've actually got a slightly greater concentration of export markets in the major resource holders. It doesn't grow as fast as it does in the reference scenario, but still they play a very important role and an increasingly important role over the 25 years to 2030. That again is the OPEC share on the right axis. You can see to 50% in 2030 under the reference scenario, and under the alternative policy scenario, they only grow to about 43% of the market share. Alternative policy in gas imports, interregional trade grows more slowly in the alternative policy scenario. It's down by some 200 BCM per year. Out at the end, you can see the 90, 46, and 33. This again because of more efficient power generation, more renewables, more nuclear. The same things that are influencing the oil markets have a tendency to influence the gas markets. And you see a particularly sharp impact on gas supplies coming out of Iran because of Iran's sensitivity to other more proximal gas taking up more of the market share. The alternative policy scenario is composed in large measure of end-use efficiency, which is about two-thirds of the savings, switching to less carbon-intensive fuels, improved supply-side efficiency, another 13%, increased renewables some 12%, and increased nuclear some 10%. Emissions in China still rise by 4 gigatons between 2004 and 2030, accounting for half of the global increase under the alternative policy scenario. Emissions in the OECD actually peak in about 2015 and begin a decline in the alternative policy scenario, and there are those who argue and have run the scenarios to suggest that APS, that alternative policy scenario, continued on to 2050, begins to achieve stabilization. I'm dubious about that. I'm not prepared to take that position here yet, but there is some argument that scenario in and of itself is enough to begin achieving stabilization. If you, using the obverse of the dirty dozen here, the clean dozen, within the policies, the 1,400 policies that we've added up, if you just take these dozen in these places, U.S., EU, and China, you can save yourself about 40% of the alternative policy scenario. It isn't that big a mix of things, and they're fairly straightforward. There's no radical policy here that couldn't reasonably be enacted. And if you add to this a Russia, and I think we'll put a Russia box on here in the next time we come out, getting at such things as flaring, inefficient gas production, subsidies of the Russian domestic market, compressor units, various things that are going on in Russia that could improve the efficiency of the Russian gas system, just that, district heating, you could probably save 100 BCM of gas in the Russian system. And that would be a very substantial contribution either to supply or to reduce consumption. The cost effectiveness of the efforts, total energy investment from production to consumption, is lower in the reference scenario. Obviously, you don't need as many power plants as if your demand has been reduced. Initially, consumers are going to spend $2.4 trillion more in this time frame for more efficient cars, more efficient refrigerators, more efficient whatever else it may be. There's a premium that you pay up front. But by investing that $2.4 trillion, $3 trillion less is required on the supply side. That's the power plants. You remember we've talked about the one-watt initiative or the set-top boxes. The standby power initiative could save you something like 10 nuclear power plants just by the fact that you don't need that power. So there's a tremendous savings on the supply side. Each dollar invested in more efficient electrical appliances saves 2.2 in investment in power plants and networks. Each dollar in more efficient oil-consuming equipment saves 2.4 in oil imports to 2030. The higher initial investment is by consumers is more than offset by fuel cost savings, but that's only part of the story. The rest of the story is that you get a payback just by having bought the less expensive equipment, and the payback is not that long. If you look at cars in the OECD or non-OECD, you're paid back in a matter of 2 to 3 years. If you look at motors and industry, same thing, 2 to 3 years in the OECD in the first half, and then as the lower hanging fruit is picked in the first half, it gets a little more expensive to do it in the second half. But the time frames are quite short. Now, these are perhaps the easier examples of payback periods. There are some tougher ones, housing retrofits, commercial buildings, power sector generally, major industrial capital stock turns over much more slowly, social infrastructure. These are things that are much tougher to change. They take 10, 15, 20, 30 years, and the problem with them is always that the investment you need to make up front is so large and the payback period is so long that we've got a sequencing problem, and nobody's prepared to do that stuff commercially. It's the same thing that happens when you try to build a nuclear power plant. Who's going to carry that upfront capital cost, even though the fuel costs are lower later on? So we've got a basic problem in somehow smoothing the return to the high upfront capital costs. It occurs in a lot of places. We have a new nuclear chapter in this book. We have always had a positive view of nuclear as an essential component to any energy mix that's going to deal with the security of supply and with the climate change challenge. The payback time of the policies on nuclear power are one of the major constraints here, but the growing concerns over energy security, obviously the rising carbon emissions, these are things that are driving renewed interest in nuclear power. The frustration at the runaway oil prices and the pursuit by gas prices. It has all of these positive aspects that everybody's talked about before, but governments are still going to have to deal with the problems of the investment. Again, that very heavy upfront capital load, which is less difficult to manage given today's economics. But there's the operational safety issue. There is the high-level waste disposal issue. There is the fuel cycle proliferation issues. These have not been sufficiently addressed for many of our populations, and so our ability to put these power plants in is still sharply constrained by politics and by the difficulty of financing something that has got that many uncertainties to overcome. This is a little discussion about the vulnerability of these various sources of power to fuel cost increases. Obviously, wind is not expensive. It's quite free. Well, hot air sometimes can be fairly costly, but this is Washington. You all understand that. But the other ones, you can see that the least sensitive is nuclear. Nuclear power has got a very small piece of the uranium has got a very small piece of the cost of generating nuclear electricity, something like 3%. Gas is 38%, coal 21%, so that a 50% increase in a uranium price is not a very damaging thing to a nuclear power operator. We have seen the contrary on gas, in as much as we were saying earlier, the marginal supply of electricity now in many markets around the world, the United States, elsewhere, is coal, just because of the price of gas and the probable direction of gas prices. The base price of gas, I'll have to ask for a reference back into the book there. Don't know offhand. A lot of talk about biofuels as part of the answer. Interest is soaring. Biofuels can help address energy security, of course, by just the diversity of the sources of biofuels, geographic and whether ethanols or out of oil seeds. Higher oil prices have certainly made biofuels more competitive. You've got to be a little attentive to how firmly we can believe that those oil prices are going to dominate out into the future and what exposure you take on by putting in higher cost biofuels opportunities. The availability of arable land constraining biofuels, we need to be careful about that one and look behind what's being said versus what's going on. We've been told in Brazil, for instance, that there's plenty of arable land. It's not a problem, and we don't have to chop down rainforests to put more sugarcane in. But we are putting the sugarcane in where the cows used to graze, and the cows are going to have to graze somewhere, so they're chopping down the rainforest so the cows can graze. So you got to look a little bit further than the first answer to see whether indeed the competition for arable land is being met in an environmentally sustainable way. The same thing of the issue of competition between food and fuel. We've seen it already in sugar between sugar and sugar ethanol. And if we remove some of the perversities in the economics or in the trade of ethanol, we might find a few others. Here in the United States, the least energy efficient of the biofuels is, of course, corn. And if you take out some of the trade protection and the inducements, the fiscal and the rest of it, corn doesn't look very good. And the actual fuel-to-fuel savings, the amount of fossil fuel that you need to generate the corn output is not that brilliant compared to, say, sugar. Obviously, the longer-term prospects are to move into lignocellulosics that look very good, but they are quite a ways out. They would require a much lower quality arable land, a crop that wouldn't be competing on food markets, a pretty good option, but we're going to have to spend some money to get there. In the book, you'll see some comparisons of the costs and the benefits of these various fuels, and we have also put out another book on biofuels that gets pretty far into the tall grass on the economics. You may want to take a look at that. Share of biofuels in road transport consumption, well, right now it's only about 1%, and between now and the end of the alternative policy scenario, it could be as high as 7%. That's not a lot, But again, if I could go back to the cautionary note, to let's not confuse energy policy with agricultural policy, with electoral policy, with landscape architecture. Let's make sure that we're looking at the economics of these things in an energy context and scrubbing the numbers that way. We have another publication out. I'm not going to try to explain this slide to you. This is Energy Technology Perspectives. It's a book we put out in about June, July, somewhere back there. And what we've said is if you press the technologies, if you do everything you can on more or less understood technologies, nothing really off the wall here in the first decades, what can you do to achieve a reduction in emissions back to, say, 2003 levels? We created some scenarios. There's a MAP scenario, a carbon capture and storage, no carbon capture and storage, a low efficiency, and then a Tech Plus, which is aggressively pushing all things, including the beginnings of lignocellulosic and the beginnings of hydrogen beginning to penetrate the market. You can reduce by 2050 carbon emissions to the level of 2003 or close to it, 6% above, 21%, or in the extreme scenario, 16% below. But you got to work at it. You got to start now. You got to begin pressing the technologies now. You got to begin to believe that this can be done, and start the work. One of the messages we want to have come out of this WIO is, we're not doing it. It's getting worse. There are solutions. They're available, but we've got to start now, and we haven't started yet. And this book is intended to reinforce that message. We fed this into the St. Petersburg Summit. It was tasked by the Glen Eagle Summit, where we were given a bit of a plan of action to take a look at some of these issues in various sectors of the economy, various sectors of the energy sector. And in technology, this was a part of our response. We'll have more to say in Germany at the summit next year, and then finally reporting to the Japanese summit in 2008 on this. We did a chapter in this book on Brazil. I won't go into Brazil now in any depth. It's a sort of an introductory. It's a primer on Brazil. We don't pretend to be giving you a chapter of in-depth analysis on Brazil. That's a book in its own right. We are working with the Brazilians on this. They asked for us to not come down and present the Brazilian chapter until after Lula got reelected, so we have deferred that until January or February. They have said, we're putting out our own projections in December, and your projections are a little bit more pessimistic than ours, and we don't need that in our electoral process. And so fine. These are the realities. We'll go off back down and talk to them later. They're doing really well. Now, this is the oil self-sufficiency, and, of course, that was helped post-2003 dramatically, because it's only really in 2003 that gas oil caught on in Brazil. It wasn't as far back as we've been hearing about it, but it finally got traction in 2003. It has to do with Petrobras being a fairly good company and a fairly good relationship with the internationals, the majors, going off into deep water, finding a lot of oil, and over time coming down to where they achieved self-sufficiency in April of 2006. They were pounding themselves on the chest in April of 2006 when on May 1st they got hit by Bolivia, who said, your gas is cut off, so you're back in trouble again. That wasn't a very cheery note at the time. And you've watched the debate since that time, really stumbling and bumbling along, not a very good dynamic in Latin America with this sort of resource nationalism complicating everybody's lives. And Hugo Chavez out cheering on any form of resource nationalism and perversity in markets. So it makes life a little bit tough. But frankly, I think that Morales and Lula are coming to an understanding. The companies are finding some common ground, some deals are being signed, people are feeling better about the gas relationship, so perhaps this will sort itself out and the Brazilians can go back to feeling good about being self-sufficient in oil. They will be self-sufficient in gas because they're not going to forget this. This is the second major kerfuffle. You may remember some years ago, Brazil was having a drought. Their hydro went down to below base load, and they had to import tremendous volumes of gas from Bolivia. Then when the hydro filled back up again, they just cut the gas off from Bolivia. So they sort of deserve each other in this sense. But I believe now they're coming to a more stable condominium. So a final slide, current trends. We are on course for an unstable, dirty, and expensive energy future. Well, not to put too fine a point on it. We've got some work to do in promoting energy investment. It's got to be the right investment. We're not convinced that the investment we're seeing is going to get into the energy efficiency business. Again, this question of of sequencing. Energy efficiency requires a major upfront. If a guy's building a house and he's going to sell you the house, but he can't be the beneficiary of the more efficient furnace, he's not going to put it in the house. What can we do to empower the consumer to make sure he does, and what can we do to make sure he gets paid for putting it in the house? It's got to be in the price. In addition to improving energy security, all of these efficiency arguments make sense anyway. What would be wrong with that? The environmental arguments all make sense. We always got some ideas. We put them out there. But the ideas in the sort of near term, the policy context, the 1400 that we've counted for the alternative policy scenario can get us started down the path. But we're not going to get all the way down the path without some technological breakthroughs. And by breakthrough, I don't mean the eurekas. I mean just pressing forward on where we are in the technologies that are before us, getting the biofuel technologies advanced, the new nuclear, the greater efficiencies throughout the system. The technological fixes can get us a long way. And with that, you have had the full Monty.
Nice work.
Thank you. Excellent presentation. As long as I've known Bill, and sometimes I think it goes back to the Lincoln administration, he's thoughtful, thorough, and provocative, and insightful in a lot of ways. And certainly this presentation today did not fail that test. So why don't we open it up for questions. Just identify who you are, and please pose your question in the form of a question. Go ahead, Alan. You want to start?
No, we'll leave peak oil as a geologic concept and economic concept. And for our purposes, with oil prices moving to where they are and the fairly reasonable assumption that they're not going to fall back below, 40, 45, it's hard to imagine. Maybe they would tank for a while and then come back up. It's clear that from 85 to 2000, oil was underpriced, and now there has been this adjustment. So prices are up, and they'll stay up. That means that a lot more of the resource base is available. A lot of stuff that had fallen off is back on the screen. So that peak oil, in a geologic sense, is a receding horizon, and we're not particularly preoccupied by that. We think we won't be able to breathe before we run out of oil. So it's more of a challenge to the fossil fuel mix than it is to the availability of the existence of the resource base. Access to that resource base, we're going to come into a period now, I think, over the next 10 years of this dynamic between IOCs and NOCs. We're going to have to sort this thing out. Right now we're in an NOC nationalistic mode because prices are so high that inefficiency doesn't cost a great deal and nobody can see it anyway. So that the NOCs are pounding their chests and saying, we don't need you. We can buy your equipment. We can buy your suppliers. We don't need to have ExxonMobil stitch together 50 companies. We'll contact them directly. Well, that's not as easy as it sounds, and you know that, and so do the other companies. And so it may take some time before the NOCs realize that they lack the organizational skills, the financial skills, the technical skills, and all the other skills, managerial skills, to make it happen. We'll see it, an example in Russia on Yamal. Russia kicked the can down the road on Shtokman because they know they can't do that, but they think they're going to do Yamal. Yamal's not that easy. They're not going to be able to do that either. But it's going to take 4 or 5 years of bumbling before they have to start bringing back in the companies. How you get around that in the rest of the world where the resource base is the best, you consider Saudi Arabia. We've always talked about having access to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is never going to allow an international oil company access on a better terms for the Saudi government than they're getting out of Aramco. They'll tax it away. Maybe they would let the companies in. So is the international company in question a better operator than Aramco? Well, Aramco's pretty good. In other places, are the companies as good? Not even close. Surgut Neftegaz, is that as good as an international company? No, maybe getting there. Lukoil, a little better. So the access issue is going to be trouble for us. I think over the next years we'll find a new dynamic between IOCs and NOCs. We'll find a better condominium. The NOCs are going to want to be out joining around the world in consortia. They're going to be quoted in our stock markets. They're going to be subjected to accounting principles. They're going to be share prices are going to be valued by some of the guys on Wall Street. So they're going to have to begin conforming more and more and will become more business friendly over time. Right now, the sort of buzz line that we're using is that access to conventional oil for IOCs has already peaked.
Just to follow that up, and we've been talking about this in the NPC study, the sense that the group is getting is that the resource endowment, if you look at conventional's conversion capacity, you know, and converting molecules into liquids, that's not the issue on peak oil. What may be the peak oil issue is the above ground issues, which is kind of what you've alluded to. David.
Thanks, Bill. IEA does a terrific service, and we're reminded every time you do one of these presentations. Transportation is a big part of your alternative policy scenario, 39% increase in efficiency and use fossil fuels. And I see you target efficiencies in the U.S. and in Europe and not in China. But I wonder, how do you get there? And what are your assumptions? It seems there are three options. There's CAFE for everybody. There's high gas taxes. And there's high prices will be high enough. The market will take care of itself. What underlies your assumption about getting that growth? What do you see for as the critical pathway for the U.S. and for Europe and for anybody else?
Yeah, the pathways may not be the same in every market. The Asian markets, Indian and Chinese markets, are more responsive to price than, say, the U.S. market. So you can, by making a more efficient car available, expect people to pick it up because they want a more efficient car. That stuff's expensive. If you pose yourself the question, why is it with prices, ever since 99 they've been starting, March of 99 when Hugo Chavez said, yes, OPEC, let's go. Here we go up the price ramp. And from 2004 and 5, we've seen these incredible increases. And yet we don't see the shift in the consumption pattern. So what's wrong with the consumer that he hasn't recognized these prices? And you have to reach the conclusion that the consumer doesn't care about these prices. That's why I took the time at the very beginning to say that curve has been established by 2 billion people. And those 2 billion people have got a per capita income that suggests they don't much care if it costs more to fuel their tanks. Those guys probably have to be regulated. Those guys probably have to be told, and Detroit has to be told, sorry, but you have got to achieve a new standard in automobile efficiency because there are some higher order public policy issues here that are not being met by the market. It's a market failure if you think markets are going to deal with the environment. Europe, I suspect the same. Anybody in that complex of a disposable income that is insensitive to energy prices is going to have to be regulated. The 5% that's driving the SUVs around Moscow, you've probably been knocked over by the BMW and the Audi SUVs in Moscow. Those guys are not responsive to prices, and the same guys are driving up and down the streets of Beijing now, and you can find them in Delhi and in Bangalore. They're not going to respond. You've got to regulate and force the industry, I think. I don't know if the IEA would even agree with me here, but I think you've got to be a much stronger regulatory approach to this issue than price. Price just doesn't work.
Bob, you come this way.
Bill, are you going to take this show to China? Are you going to take this show to China?
Are we going to take this show to China? You bet. Yeah, we're going to take this show to China. You got to be a little careful with the Chinese. They are so big and they figure so importantly in all of these numbers that they've gotten hypersensitive. They really hate to be accused of price increases in 2004 and 5 as a result of Chinese growth. And they are quite happy to move back to any per capita measure that you want to talk about. which they know is unfair because they know that it's the coast that's doing all this and the other guys are disenfranchised. But we are going to take these messages into the Chinese. We have found the new NDRC under Chen Deming is quite a responsive place. They've got limited bureaucratics. They've got 50 guys doing this. But they're listening. They're taking lessons. We've been out there with our efficiency in building. The building code seminar we had out there was wonderful. We've had an appliance code seminar. Of course, now these appliance things, these guys want to be in the markets around the world. So if we're going to be demanding appliance labeling, then they're going to put appliance labeling on their appliances. They want the markets. But I think the Chinese will be quite responsive to this. They see interest in greater efficiency. Just in preparing for the international events in Shanghai and the Olympics in Beijing, they are having to struggle mightily to clean up their air, and they're doing a lot to do that. Some of it is perversities, but a lot of it is seriously changing how they produce power and how they consume power. These are good things. So it's a receptive place right now. Yeah. India is equally receptive, but less organized. And so you may have your best debates and have your best intellectual exercises talking policy with the Indians, but then nothing happens.
Paul. Paul Connors, Canadian Embassy. Thank you very much for your presentation. I want to make sure I understood something in your presentation. What I heard was that your price assumptions are the same in both scenarios, but in your alternative scenario, you'd have oil down by 5 million barrels a day by 2015 and by 13 million by 2030. So as I do the math on that, and I might be missing something, oil consumption would be down almost 5% over the reference case and down almost 10% in the alternative case, but you don't see an impact on prices. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's the set of assumptions. The reason being that the higher cost oil comes out, the higher cost production places come out, the Caspians and the deep waters and such, and the lower cost producers take up a good part of the market share.
But in your alternative case, when you get it down 10%, wouldn't it be your marginal areas, your most high cost oil production, that would fall off? It's to me, it's a little surprising. It could be oil sands. It's surprising to me that you would get consumption down 10% and not see prices fall. And I was thinking in my mind, is he suggesting that a carbon tax fills that in? But you don't even see the prices falling?
No, we don't. I don't know if I can explain the entire dynamics of this because I don't know if I understand the entire dynamics of this. But the fact of the lower consumption takes some of the price pressure off, the efficiency effects on the consumption of oil and gas. And so the prices are not driven up. The lower cost producers take more of the market because that's the logical place to get the oil and gas. The higher cost producers, and that could be the edge of the Athabascas, or probably not a lot of them, but the edge of the Athabascas and the real deep water, or the places where the above ground risks are so high it's just not worth it, those are the ones that fall off first. Iran and gas and such like. But it's difficult to get the dynamics of this thing so that you can actually find a price track that will show a refinement in the outer years of what the alternative policy scenario implies for the earlier years. So we've just basically kept the same price track out.
Can I paraphrase that back? What I heard is with the reduction in demand, yes, you would be producing cheaper oil, but the price would stay up because on the demand side, notwithstanding that drop, the market's going to keep that price up. Is that?
Yeah, the cheaper oil is cheaper to produce for whoever's producing it, but it isn't getting into the market necessarily cheaper.
Right, because demand is keeping it up.
Yeah.
Notwithstanding the 10% drop.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Tracy.
Hi, Tracy McMinn with Shell. I had a question about, you mentioned the role of government in achieving some items in the alternative policy scenario, and I wondered if you could talk about the role of the IOC in achieving that scenario.
Well, the IOCs can do a lot to help the government get the policies in place. There's a long political process that IOCs play in frequently in many of our countries, and it would be nice to see them, all of them, take up a sort of uniformly supportive stance on what needs to be done for the longer-term good. They can also do that in the various places around the world where they're working to some extent. The IOCs don't have the best podium for being proponents of public policy. But the way they position themselves can be reinforcing of what the public is trying to do. And in some cases, IOCs can be a perverse impact on that. Now, in some cases, again, it's getting to be how you defend IOCs. Is Petronas an IOC now? Is CNPC anywhere near an IOC? Well, inside China it's not, but outside China it might be. And so the comportment of those IOC-NOC hybrids also has some impact on whether or not public policy moves in the right directions. Some of the above-ground risks in frontier areas are political risks, they're corruption, there are various things like that. Public policy works to contain those things, to restrict them, to diminish them, and yet IOCs are in a position to reward those things. And that becomes a perversity for public policy. So, yeah, there are lots of things IOCs can do, but they are not going to be they're not going to be at the podium, pounding the podium for public policy.
No, exactly. And I was wondering if I guess I see our contribution is mainly in the role of R&D and technology development, and that was one area that you didn't mention, but is that kind of how you would see it as well, in addition to sort of, you know, public policy contribution?
The R&D and technology is assumed. The other part is less evident.
Let me ask it's more of a texture question. If you look at the growth in non-OECD, we're also the conventional resources are non-OECD, OECD. We talk about the developed nations and conforming to the market under the rules which we've proposed and have lived by for the last 30, 50 years. Do you ever worry that when you get non-OECD consumers dominating the market and non-OECD producers dominating the market, that we shift to a different type of market structure? That it looks different than it looks now? You can take 2 days to answer that.
Yeah. I mean, our assumption on engaging the rest of the world more intensely, and our governing board has said get out there and do it, spend more time in China, India, and Russia. They won't give us the budget to get there, but they want us to do it. But then you all know about that. It's obvious that we are concerned that we will lose control of this. We've lost control of demand growth. We've lost control of the supply side. We haven't any control or degree of control over the transit routes and the rest of it. So obviously we would like to project our best practices, our policy experiences to the rest of the world, so they pick that up in the first place. And without being too arrogant about it, because if you look at how we've consumed energy over the last decades, we've got quite a bit to do in cleaning up our own act. So we're projecting this as let us come out and show you what we've done and the mistakes we've made and the successes we've had. You tell us about your experiences, because Chinese electrification, they must have some things to tell us about how you do that, and other things around the world. The Brazilians have some things to teach us. Make this a process where we all identify that we've got these challenges, which are common, and they're not OECD challenges, they're global challenges, and that we join in addressing them, as opposed to basically turning over the game to the next guys, because mm-hmm. we've had our run at it, and now they're bigger and more numerous than we are, and so it's up to them to define the rules. I think we want to help them define the rules of that next period.
Yeah, I'm sure we want to help them. I'm just wondering what kind of leverage we have going forward, because the world is shifting.
Well, I think the leverage is predicated on the fact that we've learned a lot, and a lot of what we're trying to do now is basically right. I think we're still arrogant enough to think that we're basically right, and and I hope that we're convincing in taking that message out, so that China says, well, yeah, this form of transportation, or this form of social infrastructure, or this approach to technology does make sense, because we are in the same markets. I mean, like the Chinese 6 or 7 years ago, very difficult to talk to, because they hadn't really internalized the fact that they are really in the market. They're out there now. They were only 2 or 3 years after they started importing the first barrels of oil, and that didn't really strike home. But now they know they're exposed.
Right.
They're exposed to the oil markets. They're exposed to the gas markets. They've learned that recently. They're exposed to the carbon dioxide issues and the pollution issues. And so I think they are looking for the best available practices. They'll happily build on that, and hopefully we can learn from them as they build and engage us as if these are common problems for which we need to find common solutions.
Okay. Yeah, Mark.
Yeah, real quick. China and India specifically, I guess I've been a lot with those two countries. They are both in, you know, pretty big build-outs right now on the electricity side. One of my discussions with very adverse to advanced technology. They have such a yawning gap right now. The need for electricity. I know my discussions in IDCC with them, they've been pretty opposed to clear up when there's certainly risk of technology. I guess my question is, what do you see or how open are they going to be to using cutting-edge technology that may not necessarily be proven or the level of reliability that they would like? I guess my sense is that, you know, we assume a lot of technology that's happening here, but maybe too little too late looking at the build-out chart. Any thoughts on that? Especially in regards to greenhouse gases, I guess that really comes into play.
Yeah. Well, if you take the macro sort of political perspective on this, when Hu Jintao was running to take his new job, he would visit with the miners around the country, and he would say to the his position at the podium was, there are too many Chinese who have not shared and participated in the economic miracle of the last decades. Since 1988, we've been on a reform track. Tremendous things have happened. Look at Shanghai. Look at these cities, Guangzhou, the amazing progress that's been made, but not everybody's been brought along. My job as premier is to bring you along. It's pretty hard to do that if you double the electricity rates. And it's pretty tough to pick up the technologies that you're talking about if you can't pay back the guy that's investing in them in the first place. And so they've got a fundamental tension between mainstreaming the sort of average Chinese guy and taking up the technologies. Now, if you look at the mix of power plants they're putting in, there are quite a few ultra-supercritical power plants going in. They are picking up things that have been demonstrated. I don't think they're prepared to go out to the edge and test technologies. They're going to rely on us to do that. But they are looking for ways to restructure. They are looking for ways to bring order to their electricity system generally. They've gotten out ahead of themselves a little bit in terms of unbundling into generation units and such, and they haven't really got a trading system. They haven't got a transmission system. So they've got quite a bit to do, but they recognize that they have got to move electricity rates in such a way, perhaps by protecting that lowest echelon group, you know, the 50 kilowatt hour, the 100 kilowatt hour thing, protecting them in some way and moving rates into the Chinese economy that can tolerate it, because its comparative advantage is low labor costs for the time being, and it can probably tolerate slightly higher energy costs, and get them in there so that they can begin building the kinds of capacity they know they need. Slow process. And the guy who's making the decision out there at the point of investment, who wants to bring kilowatt hours to the bus bar, he would probably prefer straight burn coal, but he's being constrained by the policies that are getting more and more rigorous, and the political concerns of the citizens around who are tired of having their lungs and their cars pitted by coal fallout. So it's just going to take some time. And the fact is that when you look at China, you think of it as a command-and-control economy, and you look at the Communist Party and all these little guards standing outside the ministries and think, my God, they've got control. They don't. The parallel economy in that country is absolutely huge, and you can make all the official declarations you want, but when you take it out to the municipal level and watch what's happening in that municipality, it may or may not have any resemblance to the national policies. It's a pretty tough challenge. None of us have tried to bring order to a country of 1.3 billion people before. So they're struggling.
Any question on this? Go ahead.
Andy Patterson with Environmental Business International. Let's go to who's going to build all this stuff, Bill. Bechtel, Jacobs, Fluor, they're all backlogged down in the mailroom. They're even turning your phone off at the marketing department. These firms have very limited bonding capacity, which I believe in the way of deploying the new technology, whether it's IPCC or something else. Exxon, Shell, those folks have the bonding capacity to put in the conventional approaches, but we don't have an engineering base worldwide to put in $20 trillion that you're talking about. And so I'm wondering whether you've looked at this manpower issue and this construction capacity issue. Assuming that the $20 trillion, even if it appears, will actually be deployed.
Well, I don't think the oil, gas, coal component of the $20 trillion is very tough, and I don't think the OECD component of the electricity is very tough. The rest of the world electricity is the toughest part of that $20 trillion. But it's not a lot of money in 25 years. If the if the players that you're talking about are there. We are going through a particular period now where absolutely everything is stressed out, which is why we're seeing those cost inflations across the board. And in as much as we're dealing here with a 25-year time frame, we don't assume that's going to persist forever. We've seen these cycles before, and they do sort themselves out. There are actually kids going to school now to become petroleum geologists, can you imagine? Wouldn't do that 10 years ago, but you are now. It takes a while for them to get into the system. Takes a while for that to begin to iron out. It is true that the major American companies that you're talking about, major European companies, are booked out. There are a lot of other companies around the world that may not be the first order. It's Team B, maybe Team C. And I wouldn't underestimate Teams B and C to do quite a bit of work themselves, and maybe they don't need the big guys, and so the big guys are going to want to pay attention to maintaining their market share, and so don't be so booked out that they don't answer the phone. I think some of this will sort itself out. Again, the ability to mobilize that $20 trillion depends on whether the conditions are right, and if the above-ground risks in the oil and gas sector are not right, then that money won't flow. And if the investment conditions in downtown Congo are not such that you want to build a power plant, you're not going to build a power plant, and so you don't need that much money. And the $20 trillion, again, assumes that same flight path, and we hope that flight path is wrong. We hope we can cut back dramatically on that and use a lot less energy and deliver the same social goods, the same energy services with a lot less energy, so a lot less than that $20 trillion. We can only hope. The policies should go in terms of efficiencies, which is the really big one for us. For the next decade or two, efficiency is the really biggest thing out there. We should be able to lower that curve quite substantially.
Bob, go ahead.
Bill, good to see you again. You talked about resource nationalism. You mentioned Hugo Chavez and Bolivia. What about our leverage over Putin and Russia? Isn't he exercising resource nationalism as much as any of these other leaders, and what can we do about it?
Well, Putin, when he came to the White House, the Kremlin was run by the oligarchs, and he had to make the point that he runs the Kremlin, and so he does now, and the oligarchs are a little more attentive to him. He has used the energy sector as his destrier. He's ridden that horse into battle, and it has served him well. Gazprom, for him, has basically put him back in the catbird seat. He has gotten his money from it. He's gotten his political influence. He's gotten his geopolitical stance in the near abroad, the further abroad, and down into European markets. He has found that bringing order to the energy sector has been the single most power-consolidating thing that he's done, and he rather likes that. There were a lot of us who said, fine, it's probably time to do that because the place is a mess. You got pillaged in the oil sector. Don't let yourself get pillaged in the gas sector. Don't let it happen on electricity. Don't move too fast on this privatization or you'll end up with the same concentrations of power and different oligarchs. Well, we're finding that he does have different oligarchs. We call them statogarchs or bureaugarchs or whatever you want to call them. They work in the Kremlin instead of out in the city now. The Sechens and the Medvedevs and the guys like that who are basically calling the shots on Rosneft and Gazprom. It's reflective, and it's not just about the oil sector. It's reflective of the entire direction of Putin's policies. It's about NGOs. It's about the press. It's about civil liberties. It's about a lot of things that are going in the wrong way. And I think most of our countries have recognized that there are divergences now in how we in the West, in the G7, view the world and how Russia in the G8 views the world. St. Petersburg didn't do much to correct that because there weren't any sharp edges to St. Petersburg because it's very difficult to get the seven to speak with one voice. You might get the Japanese and the U.S. to speak a bit with one voice, but the Europeans right now are feckless and cannot speak with one voice, and they're going to have to find a way to do that or they're going to get salamied up by this Russia and lose big time. Russia started the process of reuniting the Europeans to some extent with its brusque attitude and the sharp claws on the bear and the Ukraine-Russia spat last January. That was quite useful. We appreciated the Russians doing that because it allowed us to make some points that we had been trying to make on the energy front. But it's much broader than energy. And we're going to see this, I suspect, continue at least until the election in 2008, continuing consolidation of power. the Russian people approve of their president. Many presidents around the world would be jealous of his approval ratings. And so after, and you were on the streets, Bob, you saw in Moscow in the early 90s soldiers begging to stay fed, and the amount of the amount of collapse in the superpower to where it was just a groveling third world country. And the Russians don't tolerate that well. They're a proud people, and they want to stand up, and they feel as if they're standing up now, and they're happy to be that way. And I don't think they've begun to count yet the costs of their current profile. There's a lot of costs, a lot of leakages, Gazprom, and the oil sector, and the electricity sector, and across the raw materials, there's a lot of leakages from that economy that could serve that economy rather well. And I don't think it'll be too long before the Russian people begin to wake up to that. If this winter we have another harsh winter, there's going to be a deliverability problem, a gas deliverability problem. Gazprom did itself so much damage in Europe last year with that Ukraine event and then the cascade down into Europe that it's probably going to want to avoid that. But if there is a problem, they have to absorb it somewhere. And they're not going to absorb it in Moscow, and Mosenergo is going to get the gas it needs. It'll absorb it outside. And we're going to hear the stories again from some of those places where people are freezing in the dark. That is not going to go down politically well. And it may be one of those wake-up calls to Putin himself that while he has ridden that battle horse for some time, he's got to bring some discipline to that battle horse, because what's good for Gazprom is not necessarily good for Russia.
Okay. Thanks. All right. Terrific. Join me in thanking Bill Ramsey. This excellent presentation and topic for further discussion.